Welcome back to another edition of the Fried Egg Podcast. Today's episode is powered by TD Ameritrade. Whether on the course or in the market, it helps to have a second set of eyes to keep you on your game. That's why TD Ameritrade's trade desk is here to help gut check your strategies so you always feel confident teeing up a trade. Visit tdameritrade.com/friedegg to learn more about what their trade desk can do for you. Member SIPC. We are back with another edition of the Fried Egg Podcast. Today, I am joined by 2019 U.S. Mid-Am champ, Lucas Michel. Lucas is an Australian. He's the first international player to win the U.S. Mid-Am. He won it last week out at Colorado Golf Club. He is from Perth originally, but went to school in Melbourne. And we get a little bit on Lucas's background. Is how he got into golf and how he got to the U.S. to play the Mid-Am and his plans for the next year, as well as a little bit on the Mid-Am. Enjoy the episode. Lucas is a golf course architecture nut. In fact, he's now texting me pictures of a seaside course that he found in Perth, sand greens. He's just a golf tragic. So it's a interesting conversation, and really looking forward to seeing Lucas play the next year on TV in the U.S. AM Masters and U.S. Open. So without further ado, here is Lucas Michel.
The fried egg requires a different technique. What you need to do is actually square the face so it'll dig down underneath that bad lie and propel that ball right out onto the green.
Here's the thing, playing out of a buried lie in a bunker is completely different than playing out of a nice, clean lie in a greenside bunker.
You need to be aggressive on any shot, whether it's sitting cleanly or it's a fried egg.
Well, we've all faced it, the dreaded fried egg. It's not to be feared, though. It's actually a pretty easy shot to hit.
Best AM events are like the invites at clubs.
Yeah.
Like the, you know?
Yeah.
It's
so yeah. True. And like, I've seen, like, I've obviously played a few of them now. And like, I thought the Northeast AM was probably as good as it gets, really. I mean, that course is awesome. One of my set. And then like the club runs it perfectly. And they get in there, like, I think they get in the, where is it? Rhode Island. Yeah. The Rhode Island State Golf Association comes in and kind of does the rules and stuff like that. But the club still runs the tournament properly, and you know, they take ownership of it, and they just do it right.
What made you start playing stuff like Northeast AM, Wanamoyset, like traveling over the U.S. to play?
I finished my studies at uni in end of 2017. I'd never been to the US to play golf, but I'd always kind of gone around and played top level amateur stuff, you know, through, you know, Europe and the UK, and I don't know, I had a pretty keen interest in it all, in playing good courses and playing competition golf. So I sort of started out, I guess, I mean, as a junior, you play competition golf, and then I kind of got old enough that I'd kind of get into some big events back home, and then at some point you start wanting to travel overseas. So my first sort of big ones were when I traveled to the UK and played the Dutch Amateur at a course called Eindhoven, which is like a good Harry Colt course. There's actually a bunch of really good Harry Colt courses in the Netherlands. Then I played the Walton Heath Trophy, which is I think it's Herbert Fowler, Walton Heath, but it's like great old school architecture, really early golden age. So it's like kind of it's a bit rougher around the edges in terms of like the shaping and stuff like that. So that's really cool to see. And then I played like the north of Scotland. I think that was at a course called Lossiemouth. Actually, it's called Moray Golf Club, but it's in Lossiemouth. And then I kind of just started traveling around and really enjoyed the element of playing really good courses and really good tournaments. That was on the way to an exchange for my university degree where I did 6 months in St. Andrews. So that was, I guess, the start of a bit more love for Lynx golf and all that. So
that had to be cool. Get the exchange, get to go spend 6 months at St. Andrews. That's one of my regrets now. Never doing a broad thing.
Yeah, I think it was funny. Like when I moved to, so I moved from Western Australia. I grew up as a kid in Western Australia, and I moved to Melbourne, and I started studying at the University of Melbourne. And I didn't kind of realize, but Melbourne Uni had this exchange program with the University of St. Andrews, and it took me until my third year before I realized it actually was there. And then I remember looking online and it said, you know, University of St. Andrews. And I'm like, hold on a minute, like that's the St. Andrews, isn't it? Like in Scotland. And I looked it up and it was, but there was only one spot for an exchange. So I kind of looked into it a bit more and applied, and I just had my fingers crossed. And eventually got that spot in there. And then that was the sort of the trip I planned. My first overseas trip I sort of planned was to go play some events before I went in and studied at St. Andrews. And so that was sort of the lead. And I played those ones I sort of talked about just then, like in the Netherlands and in England and up in Scotland. And then had 6 months over in St. Andrews, which was, I mean, it's actually the best deal in the world because you're effectively considered a town resident. What they call it's a Lynx ticket, which is it's a £200 pass for all seven courses of the St. Andrews Lynx Trust. So that includes like the old course, of course, and that lasts a year. So you pay £200 for a year's golf on unlimited golf on any of the courses, including the old course. So it's I made the most of that. I think I probably played the old course in over the 6 months, probably like, I'm going to say like 30 times, 25 times. I don't know. And then the new course, a bunch, and the Jubilee and the Castle and all of them. They're all really, really good. So that was pretty much a dream come true for someone like me.
I need to look up like graduate programs at University of St. Andrews.
Yeah. You know? Yeah. It's a good university. I'm pretty sure they just got rated like number one in UK for some list. I don't know what exactly it was, but it's where the Prince and Kate Prince William and Kate met, I think. Yeah. So it's a pretty like prestigious uni, but it's an unbelievable deal to be able to do that.
Were you playing golf at University of Melbourne then? And then,
yeah, back home, like college golf doesn't really exist in Australia. It's kind of disappointing. So all the golf that I played has been outside of any university or college programs. So I've just, the way it sort of works back home is the guys that I'm kind of friendly with that sort of my age or a bit younger tend to play their golf separate to any college affiliation. But we've got good state sporting organizations that sort of run high performance programs. And through those, it's kind of like a team training environment and that's how the players get better in that sort of way. So it's definitely a bit different to college. I studied engineering at uni, and through that I kind of didn't really play any golf while I was actually at uni, but I played it all on the side in the summers and played all my tournaments. We've got a good amateur circuit in Australia. We always get a few top players come down and they'll play like the Master of the Amateurs, Aussie Amateur, and a few of the other big tournaments. So, yeah.
So since you graduated, do you graduate when you're 22-ish?
Yeah, so started out doing a Bachelor of Science, which took 3 years. So I finished that when I was like 21, and that was when I was doing my exchange in the last year of that. And then when I finished that, I went straight in and started an engineering master's degree because where I was studying at Melbourne, they didn't offer a Bachelor of Engineering. They only did the engineering programs through Masters. And I kind of always knew I wanted to do an engineering degree just because I was more of like a math science-y kind of guy. And so I kind of ended up doing another 2 years there. So I finished when I was 23, I think. So I kind of took my time a bit doing it. I think I took an extra year than what was allocated. It's normally a 5-year program. I took 6. So finished when I was 23 and then just sort of didn't really want to go into full-time work and felt like my golf was at a decent enough level that I thought I might be able to put a couple more years into it and maybe try a professional kind of route with it. And that's sort of what I've been doing the last couple of years. And it's been up and down, but last week's been pretty good. So yeah.
That worked out well last week, but
yeah.
Talk about how you've been, you know, most people would turn pro immediately, but you've stayed amateur while you've been working on it and you've been like, what's your life looked like for the last 2 years?
Yeah. So I actually pretty much since finishing university, I work at a golf driving range, the Melbourne Golf Academy, it's called. It's a good driving range. I just work there. I do some caddying out of Royal Melbourne and Kingston Heath. So if any of your listeners come down and need a caddy, they can just look me up and I'll try and jump in the back. I do some caddying down there. We don't officially have like caddy programs, but there's like a Sandbelt caddy program that I'm part of. And we sort of caddy all over the spot in Melbourne. So I've been doing that. And then I got a friend of mine who's opening up another golf business that I'm going to be working for soon. So that'll probably be, I'll potentially give up the driving range job to help him out. Just sort of working a lot of nights and then throwing a few caddy shifts here and there in the summers and then practicing my game. And I tried out the Australian Tour school end of last year to try and get a card over here and I guess try and make a bit more money than what I was at my caddying and driving range jobs. But I made it to the final stage, but I missed out by 2 shots. So instead of turning pro, which was kind of the plan at that stage, I decided to hold off because I knew I'd be pretty close to getting a start in that mid-amateur. And then because I only turned 25 at the beginning of the year, so it was my first year eligible, so I figured I might as well wait for that and give that a crack, and kind of paid off, I guess.
did you have to qualify for the mid, or did you get a I was exemption? An exempt.
Okay. Yeah, I was an exempt player based on the World Amateur Golf Rankings, so I think they exempt 30 of the top ranked mid amateurs, and I came in at like the 11th ranked mid-amateur or something like that. So yeah, luckily didn't have to qualify because would have been a long trip for for a little roll of the dice to try and get into it. But that was sort of the reason I came over, was because I was exempt.
So you came over, the tournament was at Colorado Golf Club in Common Ground, and you came over a little early to get acclimated.
I mean, Denver's, it's at like mile high, I think. So I came in on, it was the 9th of September, which tournament didn't start till the 14th. So I had 5 days or so before the tournament started, but we couldn't get out to practice until the 12th. The 11th, technically you could use the practice facilities, but you couldn't play the courses till the 12th. So I chatted to a good friend of mine, Mike Clayton, who's been on the pod. He had a good Clates. Yeah. Great guy. He is. And he got me out to Sand Hills in Nebraska, which I kind of thought, it'll just be like, you know, a couple hours down the road or something like that. But it was a fair trip out there. It was a 5-hour drive, but worth every second of driving out there because that place is like so cool. I loved it.
It's funny because like of where it is, like you
think. Yeah,
I was like a couple weeks ago. I was in eastern Nebraska, and I was looking at the map, and I was talking to a buddy. I'm like, I might go to Sandhills, and he's like, "What do you mean?" You're like, I'm like, I'm about as close as you can get, you know?
Yeah, pretty much. It is literally in the middle of nowhere.
Like Denver is as close as you can get, pretty much. As close to the airport as you can get.
Yeah, I think Denver and is it Lincoln is the nearest in Nebraska? I don't know. It's like 5 hours either way, I think.
Isn't it amazing driving into that place? Like you're just driving down the road and you look right and you look left and you just see golf holes that don't exist.
Yeah, and every time you're around a crest, you're thinking, where's the ocean? Because it looks like you're in like the sand dunes in Scotland. It looks identical. It's such a cool place. And yeah, like you said, like you're looking left and right and you're looking down and you're like, you almost feel like you're going to drive off the road because you're just seeing golf hole after golf hole. It's incredible.
So you spent a few days there?
I spent I slept one night there and I spent sort of two foolish sort of days. So I played the course the afternoon I arrived and then, so the guy that Mike knew was the course superintendent.
Yeah.
So I went out in the morning. Yeah, Kyle Hegland. So I went out in the morning and kind of had a chat with him because I didn't catch up with him the night before and had a chat with him while he was sort of cutting the grains and stuff, which was pretty cool. Talked about it all. And yeah, I really enjoyed that, getting up at sort of sunrise and having a walk around and having a look and taking some photos. It was awesome. That place is, it's unbelievable.
I'm convinced sunrise when the grounds crew is out, it's like, it's the best time to be on a golf course.
Yeah.
It's like so absolutely peaceful and it's just, it's so neat. How would you compare the way Sandhills plays to golf in Australia and then also in Scotland?
I mean, the Sandhills there, I think it looks almost identical to what we have down on the Mornington Peninsula in Melbourne. So like courses like St. Andrews Beach and the Dunes and Moonah Links and the National, they're all on almost identical sort of topography and vegetation. It's kind of crazy. Like when I was driving in, I was like, oh my God, like it feels like I'm like down, by the dunes or any of those courses. So it looks a hell of a lot like that sort of golf. We probably don't have the quality of the course as good as Sandhills, but there's some pretty good golf down there in down the Mornington Peninsula in Victoria. But I mean, it plays very similar. Sandhills is full kind of fescue, and our course is Bermuda fairways, at least bent grass greens. But I mean, it plays very similar, firm, fast. Wind's always an element, and similar sort of look, aesthetics, bunkering, kind of that waste bunkering kind of look. So it's it's very similar, I'd say. Yeah.
So after Sandhills, you head back, and then you this first time playing at like major elevation.
Yeah, I'd played it like, I mean, we had one. We've got a course in Australia up in Canberra that there's always a tournament every year, and that's maybe at like 1,000 meters, which is like 3,000 feet. So there's a slight noticeable like increase in distance that you hit it, but Denver was a full sort of 10%. So all your numbers, whenever you're doing them, rather than kind of adjusting my numbers for the week, I kind of just ran them backwards to what was my normal numbers and kind of worked off them. So like if it was 160, then I'd take 10% off, which is 16 of 160. And then so it's 144 and just play that number. So that's sort of how I approached it. But yeah, I definitely felt like that. I didn't realize at first, but you just have to drink so much water and so easy to get dehydrated and I had a headache for a bit. And it's definitely like has an effect, the elevation, particularly I've been at sea level my whole life. So yeah, I'm definitely took a while to get used to, but I just got over it in the end.
I was out there a couple of weeks ago for a wedding and it's like, you go to a wedding and the next morning you're just so dehydrated because
he's so dry in the mouth. It's crazy.
It's nuts.
And if you were drinking alcohol as well, you would have noticed it because I had a beer or two like on a couple of the nights and just felt hammered with about a couple sips.
Yeah, it's wild. So did you notice the ball like go straighter, or was
Yeah, I did notice that. No, I agree with that. Like, I think it's like there's less air resistance against it, so it kind of just like doesn't fizz as much with the wind, with the spin. And yeah, definitely you notice like if you carve one offline, it might be like you feel like you just healed it or something, and it should have cut like 30 yards offline. It only goes like 20. Yes, you can definitely see it sort of floats up a bit more and doesn't crazy curve offline.
Yeah. I heard Colorado was playing like really firm.
Oh yeah. It was perfect for me, because like we play golf like that all summer. All our tournaments all summer are like that. Especially the ones in Melbourne. I think the Aussie Amateur is in Melbourne every second year, so every second year it'll pretty much be on a sandbelt golf course. Last year was at Woodlands Golf Club, which is one of those sort of under the radar kind of sandbelt tracks. Mm-hmm. And it was exactly like that. You know, greens rolling at 12 or 13 and fair bit of slope on them, and then rock hard greens that you have to, like a 9-iron, you got to account for like 6-7 yards of roll or bounce and roll. And even if you're coming in as high as you can, like it's still going to roll out heaps. So it kind of made it the process of calculating yardages, because you had the 10% with the elevation of the site. So you kind of go with that, with those numbers. So say that 160 number again, you go, okay, that's 144. And then it's going to roll out like 6. So that's like carrying 138. And then it might be uphill plus 4 or something. So then it's like 142. And then you're like, oh, wind, that might be like into the wind, like, and you think it's like 10. So then there was so much to think about, which is obviously, I guess, makes it more interesting, I think, when you've got to think about what you're doing a bit more.
Do you feel like that playing in that firm conditions was a big advantage? Obviously, like, you know, most of American golf is not firm and fast.
Yeah. No, I actually think it was a pretty big advantage, because, yeah, I mean, Royal Melbourne, you're doing the exact same things whenever you're playing there. You never, whatever number you shoot with your laser, you're always like, it's always different. It doesn't matter what. So, you're never carrying it to the pin at Royal Melbourne. So having a lot of experience playing that sort of golf, I think, and golf where you really have to think about where you are going to hit it to, because there was a lot of short side misses as well at Colorado, because they were so firm and fast. If you did miss it in a spot that, you know, a bunker that was, you know, short sided to a pin, or where the green ran away from you, or in the rough somewhere where you just couldn't miss it, like you really had to think about where those misses were, and I guess even from the tee sometimes had to think about, you know, how you avoid that miss by hitting it somewhere off the tee. So yeah, it was a lot to think about. There was a really good, the 16th hole was really interesting. It was a split fairway hole, which is kind of always like, you can either nail it or you can just screw it up. Because, you know, either everyone goes one way, or, you know, or they get it right and some people go both ways. And I think they got it pretty good, because pretty much everyone I played with were going down the wide route, which is down the left, and hitting probably driver. But the angle into that green as a par 5 was so poor that you just couldn't hold the green with the firmness of them and the speed. You just couldn't hold the green from the left fairway. Whereas if you went down the right, it was only a 3-wood and it was a shorter route in, and you played more across the green, so it wasn't running steeply away from you, and you could hold like a 7-iron or 6-iron against it. And I went down the right my last two rounds. And I won.
It almost is like a Redan slope from the right.
Pretty much, yeah.
You.
Like the Redan, it pretty much looks like a Redan from the right fairway, and then from the left fairway, it looks like you're just playing straight down, like imagine a Redan, you're just playing straight down from the left of a Redan.
Yeah,
where you just can't stop it. Yeah, exactly. So it's it was effectively like that, and I played down the right both times, like hit good 3-woods and hit I think a 6-iron and a 5-iron in, and made birdie both times against Stewart, and then in the last round against Joe. So I guess playing that strategy of taking a more aggressive tee shot, which was a bit narrower, and a bit harder to hit the fairway on paid off for me. So I found that interesting.
I'm looking at the hole. I haven't been out there. I'm looking at the hole, and I feel like this is like a classic case of like an example where, you know, it's way wider left, right? But
yeah,
if you look at the right and like if you just take away the left, like if you just put that fairway on any other golf hole, people would be like, oh, that's fine. It's just like you just have to lay up to the right. And then
exactly.
And it's like, it's funny how like just the giving somebody a wider option, they're always going to take it. Mm. Even though like if you just took away the left side of the fairway and made that, everybody would hit it there and have no problem with it.
Yeah. I really wanted to get Scott Fawcett's opinion of it because he was playing this week.
Yeah. So
it would have been interesting what he said because I'm sure he would have said go left. But
for sure.
When you play it, it's like, hold on a minute. Like when you see the firmness of that green and the slope, which you can't see from an aerial, you go, okay, like the right is definitely better, I think anyway. But it would have,
Because, and especially with it being a par five, I imagine, like if you don't hit a great drive, you're just laying up, you know?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, I hit it in one of the rounds. I hit it like, so the middle of the fairway is like a little creek.
Yeah.
But you can kind of get on the banks of it. And I just went down I hit it down the middle. I like pulled it and caught the bank. So I was kind of lucky it didn't roll into the creek. And then I just hit like a 9-iron out. But the wedge shot in was so, so hard. Like the pitch shot that I had to hit in. Like you actually had to nail the pitch shot or you could even wedge it off the green. Like, so it kind of made sense to go right, I think. And then have the opportunity to go for it. Because if you're playing as a three shotter down the, which a lot of people seem to do, they'd go left and then they'd play it as a three shotter. It just, you still had nothing with that wedge shot in.
It's interesting. It reminds me a little bit. There's a hole like it at Sand Valley, but it's kind of flipped the other way.
Yeah. Okay.
So it's interesting. The Coren Crenshaw definitely have some like holes that they use
they love
over,
that
like that
boomerang
print. Yeah,
they love the boomerang. That Colorado, that the 14th hole was a boomerang green. Actually, in the final round it was quite cool. It was a drivable par four, so kind of like the 8 at Sandhills, I think it's the same.
Yep.
So drivable. I hit it, I had a 3-wood. I could get a 3-wood there because it's a little bit downwind, and I hit like a great shot, but I've hit it to the left boomerang to a right pin, like front left to a front right pin. So completely, it looks like I'm completely screwed. And I kind of walk around and I'd sort of heard somewhere where Cor said, you know, every time there's always a way to kind of get it around.
Yeah.
And I kind of looked at it and
aim a way to get it close.
Yeah, exactly. And I looked and I'm like, hold on. Yeah, I actually can get this like pretty close. So we went down there. My caddy, we sort of walked around it and I looked at, if I got it close enough to the bunker, there was almost like a little valley where you could feed it in, like just on the edge of the trap where it wouldn't roll into the trap either. It would just kind of like feed into this little valley trench kind of around the bunker. And I just rolled it in there perfectly and it went down to about 5 feet and like the crowd couldn't believe it, obviously, because they just thought I was dead. But that was a cool shot to be able to play. And made birdie and half the hole with Joe. So yeah, that was really cool.
Yeah, it's curious. I think this all the time. Sometimes I think it hurts me. Sometimes I think it helps me. Do you think you're obviously have a keen interest in golf architecture? You're a golf magazine panelist. You know, you've played a lot of great places. You play on the Sand Belt, and you know, you understand the principles of architecture. Do you think it helps you as a good player understanding architecture?
I think it can. I feel like I try to understand architecture and then I kind of try to, in the same vein, kind of understand what makes you play good golf. And I think they cross over. Like Fawcett stuff kind of makes sense. I like Fawcett stuff, the decade stuff. Like I'm interested in it. And I think a lot of his stuff's correct, but they definitely overlap in parts to making you play better, I think. But I haven't really thought about it too much. What definitely hurts is when you have to play a terrible golf course, which luckily, like in amateur golf, we actually don't play too many terrible golf courses. We play much better golf courses than most of the tours play, I think.
That's one of my favorite Ogilvy things was he was like, yeah, when I was coming up, I was playing all the great amateur events and then I turned pro and I'm playing in Germany and all the, and I'm like, these places are complete shit.
Yeah, I'm not really, you know, if the pro career does take off and I, you know, turn pro and all that, I'm kind of not looking forward to that aspect of it. It'll be interesting because I haven't really had to play that much shitty golf in my life. It's been all pretty lucky, pretty good stuff.
It's funny. I kind of like enjoy playing tournaments on golf courses that offend me. It's like I have like a little bit of that where the, you know, it's right in front of you. It makes it really easy. It just becomes execution.
Yeah. And you kind of, I suppose you probably appreciate the good stuff more if you play some of the bad stuff as well.
Yeah.
So it's kind of a bit of that too.
Now for a quick word from our sponsor. Fall temperatures are here in the Midwest. This morning, it was about a crisp 55 degrees when I woke up and recorded this podcast. And, it makes taking the dog out for a walk a little bit more thoughtful. And one of the great things that I've found for on the course, those crisp mornings, is Zero Restrictions line of vests. They're all really great. I've got 3 different models, and I can't say enough good things about them. They are the absolute perfect layering option for these fall mornings. And one of the nice things about the ZR vest is they can dress up really well, and they can be a good look for going to the office as well. A button down with the vest over it. It's a great look. I would definitely check out the ZR vests. We're going to be handing out ZR vests at the Thoroughbred, our event in Aiken in October. So we love the ZR vest collection and definitely worth checking out at zerorestriction.com. Now back to our conversation with Lucas Michel. You went to Australian Q School. Obviously now you've got some pretty good exemptions coming up. What are the plans? I assume you're staying amateur for the time being, playing the Masters and US Open.
Yeah. Yeah. I'm staying am obviously until the, after the US Open. And then I kind of depends if I play really, if I say a leading am or something like that in the Masters then US Open, it kind of opens a few doors for a professional career. But I don't know, it's all sort of up in the air. I do want to turn professional eventually. That was always a goal of mine as a kid, was to, you know, I always dreamt of playing professional golf, but the more I play amateur golf, the more I kind of love it. But at the same time, I've got a good degree as well, so if I don't kind of make it as a golfer, I don't know if I can see myself as a career amateur. That kind of lifestyle doesn't really exist that much in Australia.
Mm-hmm.
That career amateur sort of mid-am, you know, crump cup kind of, you know, circuit life doesn't really exist in Australia too much. So yeah, I think I probably will give pro golf a crack after all that's done next year and try to make something of my golf.
I mean,
I'd say that's pretty likely.
Talk about a nice lineup. You get Augusta, you get Wingfoot, and if you stay for the USAM, you get Bandon.
Yeah, Bandon as well. I saw that. Yeah. Yeah, it's kind of a shame because I get actually 2 years exemption to the USAM, so I could play Oakmont the following year too if I wanted to, but yeah, I can't really see myself staying amateur that long, unfortunately. But I mean, yeah, it's pretty good. It's a pretty good little lineup. I'm going to be playing, I think, the Aussie Open as well, which is at the Australian Golf Club in Sydney, which is, you know, it's a good golf course, but it's a great event.
Yeah.
And then got a bunch of tournaments here in the summer, just amateur stuff, Australian Master of the Amateurs, which next year is at Victoria Golf Club, which is obviously a really good sandbelt club. used to be at used to always be held at Royal Melbourne, but with the Presence Cup and all that, I think they've moved it this year for the to Victoria, which is just across the road.
Just got
and Victoria's just done. Yeah, they just did a big Ogilvy Clayton Cockingmead OCCM. They did a big greens replacement sort of program. They had Poana greens for 90 years, like, and they were never quite up to the standard of all the other sandbelt clubs. So they replaced all those with a new bank grass, and they did some design tweaks to some of the ones that have been tweaked over the years by other architects, just to get them back to, I guess, what they were supposed to be like when they were first built. So I'm looking forward to that. I've played it a couple of times since it opened, and that'll be really good. And then the Australian Amateurs up in Queensland at Royal Queensland Golf Club, which is a really good track, actually. It's like another Ogilvy Clayton course. They redesigned it in like 2008 or 9, I think. Mm-hmm. And I'm looking forward to that. I've not played that one, but it looks really fun. And then I think I'm in the Vic Open as well, which is a pretty cool event. I think it should be still an LPGA,
the congruent
/ European Tour. Yeah, they run the LPGA and the European Tour event same. So it's a 36 hole venue, so same courses over the same.
You
same
mentioned
days.
It earlier, so the beach, cool. The beach course down in Mornington, right?
Yeah. Well, this one's actually the Bellarine Peninsula. So there's the Mornington Peninsula and the Bellarine Peninsula, and they both hook around Melbourne. The Bellarine's on the west side, which is where 13th Beach and both courses there are. And like Barwon Heads is another one out there, and Port Ferry's kind of more further down the road. So 13th Beach is the host of those, which is the Bellarine Peninsula, which is, I mean, it's another course that looks quite a bit like Sandhills, Nebraska, to be honest. A little bit flatter though, and it's a good, really good track, actually, 36 hole track. So that'll be really good to be part of that. I've played that tournament, played it twice before a few years ago, before it kind of got big, before it got a European Tour status I got in. But it'll be good to play it with a much stronger field for next year.
Back to the Mid-Am, I was just thinking, obviously, like, winning has a lot riding on it. When did you feel like thinking ahead became like a big thing that you had to stop yourself? You always hear people talk about staying in the present, and obviously, like, you, like, well, at what point were you, where did it really, like, you start to think, like, if I win this, I get to play in the Masters, I get to, you know?
Yeah. So from the start of the week, I had it was kind of a good sort of outlook on it, because if I didn't win, based on my performance in the Australian Tour School the year before, I still had a bunch of events I could play as a pro at the end of this year. And then if I did win, I was playing the Masters. So it was kind of like a positive sort of situation. So in the first few rounds of match play, I kind of wasn't really thinking about winning. Like, I was kind of just like, oh yeah, I'll like keep playing and playing well and kind of keep getting through. And then like, when I was like a couple down, I was like, this is okay. And like, didn't really take it too seriously, to be honest. Like, I was taking it, I was playing as well as I could, but in terms of like the consequences of playing poorly, I was like not really thinking too much about it. And then it was really when I got to the quarters and then the semis, I started thinking, okay, like, hold on, like, you've got a really good chance here to win this tournament and get all the everything that comes with it. And then that's sort of when I had to take that in a positive way to sort of make me play better rather than potentially make me play worse. So I kind of had to use that as an incentive to play well rather than also like be mindful of it affecting my performance in a negative way. So the night before the final, I was obviously getting quite a few messages of good luck and that sort of stuff. But I did not touch my phone that night. I just like refused to touch it because I just felt like any extra kind of, you know, messaging someone to say thanks or whatever was just going to kind of put extra pressure on myself in me realizing the magnitude of what I was sort of about to do potentially. So yeah, I didn't touch my phone the night before. Thankfully, I was staying with a family, sort of friends of friends, and they didn't know anything about golf. They knew I was in the final, but they kind of didn't realize the magnitude of it either. So I just sort of had a nice dinner with them, had a chat, and then tried to get an early night and went off at, you know, 9 o'clock to bed, and kind of actually slept pretty well because I wasn't really overly stressed because, yeah, the family I was with really just sort of didn't really realize what was happening.
I was going to ask, you know, like being an Australian, hey, everybody's got, obviously all the Americans probably had buddies there. You know, people from your state golf association or other tournaments.
Yeah.
Were you, did you have any friends there early in the week?
So there was really only one person I knew in the whole field, and it was a American guy. His name's Will Davenport. He's from Florida. He's a good player. He went to Yale, had a pretty good college career up at Yale. Mm-hmm. And then he went into work. He works for Boston Consulting Group, but he did a transfer down into to Melbourne, the Melbourne office in 2017, 2018. And he came down and played a couple amateur events down there. And I actually met him playing one of our small sort of local circuit events. And we hit it off really well when he was down there. And then when I went over last year, I caught up with him because he was doing grad school up in Philly. We went and played Philly cricket together. Kept hitting it off. And then so when I got into the mid-am, he also qualified through the normal qualifiers. He qualified in through one in Philly. So he was the only guy I knew in the field. But he kind of introduced me to a few guys that were playing the event. We played practice rounds together, and then he made the match play actually, and he played Stu Hagerstad in the first round. He lost like 4-3 to Stu. And I was carrying my bag all week. I carried it first two rounds of stroke play, stroke play rounds, and then I carried it first round of match play as well. When Will got knocked out, he said, "Oh, you can't be carrying your bag. Come on, man." He jumped on the bag for the rest, and I was going to probably get a caddy from about the quarters, but then he offered up, and I said, "Oh yeah, that'd be awesome." And
yeah, that had to be awesome.
Yeah,
I mean,
yeah, he's really good. He was so good on the bag, so much fun. I don't know if you saw the celebration at the end.
Yeah,
there's a video on Twitter, but we had a pretty good celebration at the end. But there was actually more to that. I don't know if you heard about the last hole, what happened there.
I saw what went down. Explain this for the listeners that didn't see the story.
So the more I think about it now, the more I'm like, hold on a minute. Like, this guy was definitely trying to do something like a bit dodgy here. So Joe Duraney, who I played, we got to the 35th hole, so two holes to play, and it was Dormy in my favor, so two up with two to play. And then we both hit the green. I hit it to 30 feet. I putted up to about 3 feet. He had a 12 footer, which if he holed, it was for birdie, and we went to the 18 obviously because he won that hole. If he missed, then I would have to hole my 3 footer to halve the hole and win the event. Well, when he missed his 12 footer, he sort of took off his hat and started walking over towards me. And I'm thinking like, gee, that's a generous gimme that he's given me here. But I'm also thinking, hold on, like, what's going on? So he comes over, extends out his hand and said, I can't remember exactly what he said, but he said like, I'm making you putt this or something along those lines, like it's not a gimme kind of thing. But good luck, kind of like shaking my hand as if like, yeah, good luck kind of thing, rather than like, yeah, thanks, good game. And meanwhile, like the USGA official basically thinks it's done. So he's running over with the trophy like towards me. And then I have to go like, oh, wait, no. He's saying, no, it's like, it's not good. It's not good. I've got to putt this. So I have to like wave him off. And then I'm like, oh, all righty. Like, shit, like this is a bit weird.
That's so strange. Yeah. I mean, so like you take your hat off.
Yeah. Well, apparently Joe explained it to the USGA guys, because the USGA guys obviously asked him afterwards, and he said, oh, like, I just got confused by the situation or something like that was his explanation. But like, the way he spoke to me about it seemed like he kind of knew what he was doing, but I don't know if he just said that to, I don't know. Anyway, to me, it seemed like he was trying to maybe create something, a bit of, you know, a bit of confusion himself to maybe put me off a little bit. That was my impression, but I don't know if that was his intention.
Jeez, that's really weird. I mean, like, I can't think of it. It's almost like icing a kicker. Like, it's so out of, like, it's not like he took his hat off and said that before any other putt, right?
No, exactly. It was so weird. So it'd be interesting. There was camera crew out there. They weren't recording it live for Fox Sports or anything like that, but there was a camera crew out there. So I'm assuming there's going to be like some sort of condensed sort of package of the final. So it'd be interesting if they, I'd love to see it again, because it was really weird. I'm sure he definitely took off his hat and he definitely shook my hand. So it'll be interesting to watch what it looks like if they end up putting it up.
Man, that's strange.
Yeah. It was really weird.
One of the oddest things I've heard in a match.
Yeah. So then I've got 3 feet to win effectively, and I'm like shitting myself, because kind of I would have been shitting myself anyway, but I've kind of had a few extra minutes to sort of think about it all, and thankfully I just sort of rolled in the right edge, kind of snuck it in there, and then that was the celebration with Will, where I just ran over to him, kind of brushed Joe off a bit, and just, I'd already shaken his hand though, so that was okay. ran over to Will and had a good hug and celebration with him. So
that's crazy. I mean, standing over that putt, I mean, you probably were just
I was trembling, like my hand, like I was about as nervous as I've ever been, for sure, because every as much as I'd been able to kind of block everything out before that, it's got to become real at some point, and that's when it came pretty real, when I had to hold 3 footer for the Masters invite. So yeah,
it's crazy. So I mean, you were down in both those matches, kind of in the final match you were down 3, and then in Stu, in the match with Stu you were down big early. Did you feel like the being down almost like locked you in a little bit more?
Yeah, and I think I certainly didn't mind being down for the final, because I think it's hard to lead all day. I just feel like there's more to lose. You feel like you're in a position to lose rather than a position to win. So kind of didn't mind being down most of the day in the final. I was actually up early against Stu, and he fought back and then got it. I think he got it back to square, or maybe one up in his favor in the back nine. But he kind of just made a couple pretty silly mistakes, particularly on 17. He just completely misclubbed, I think, on 17 in the semifinal and dumped one in the water. So, but it was, I didn't mind coming from a position of sort of having almost nothing to lose in you know, coming from a couple back. So it kind of worked for me all week. There was a lot of rounds where I came from behind. So
So I was texting with a mutual buddy, and he mentioned that, you know, your golf career might have been saved by not getting a job as a growing consultant at a golf architecture project.
Yeah, that's true. Actually, I'm interested who spoke to you about this, but
Mike Cocking. So
okay, yeah, that's quite funny. Yeah, so they're doing a project up at Port Lonsdale. It's a new sort of a new golf course, and I was planning to do the tour school, but then I was also pretty interested in my golf architecture, and my golf had been, I'd had sort of like a rough year with my golf. I'd had a fair bit of success early with my amateur golf, taking it full time. Like, I won a decent tournament early on, and then about probably a year later, I hadn't really hadn't really picked up. It's sort of been all kind of sort of mediocre results. And then this came up and I was chatting to Mike Clayton about it because they work together. And I sort of talked about it and it seemed like it was a contract. So it was only like 12 months, I think. And I sort of thought, well, that'd kind of be a cool thing to just try and see if I like it. Cause I've always been interested in the golf architecture. And if I could just try it, you know, it's a 12-month contract. It's, you know, it's just completely, once the 12 months up, you're sort of done. There's no like, no time, like you don't have to stay on really. And I figured I'd just try it out, but obviously I didn't get the role, which probably worked in my favor now looking back on it. But yeah, it would have been a cool thing to understand and all that. But I missed out, unfortunately.
it's a blessing in disguise. That's like life, you know.
Yeah,
it's almost like it, you know, you missed Australian Q School by a couple shots,
exactly.
and it works out. It's funny how
exactly.
Works.
Yeah, it is funny. So you never know what's going to be around the corner.
So you've got obviously kind of a busy schedule. You caddy at Royal Melbourne. Any thoughts on the President's Cup? Has anybody reached out to you about caddying or helping with the event?
Not really, to be honest.
Yet.
I would, yeah. To be honest, if someone said, yeah, do you want a caddy for so-and-so, I'd be like, yeah, 100%. But yeah, nothing yet. I did say, you know, you get your random people on Twitter saying, oh, they should choose Lucas as the captain's pick because his caddy's there and all this. I'm like, okay, calm down. Like, I mean, I'm going to definitely go watch it. Definitely be out there watching. I hope, the course is so short. Like, it's, I don't know what it is. It's probably like 6,200 meters, which is like 6,800 yards. It's like so short for those guys. So it'll be interesting how it plays. I'm sure the greens will be firm and fast, and you know, scoring it'll still be pretty low, but it'll at least be interesting to watch with the firmness of the greens and the speed of them. And the fairways are so wide, the guys will not know what to do, I think. It'll be interesting. Yeah, I'm looking forward to it.
I think that it'll be really cool to watch because you'll see so many of those in between holes where it's like you can push driver up to 30 yards, but do you really want to do that? Should you lay back?
My favorite one of those is the third on the west course, which is probably, it's kind of comes in at a shit point in the round because I think it's the first, of the composite for the President's Cup. And it's like, normally when we play it, if I'm just playing it with friends, it's just like a driver to get it in like the swale short of the green. And from there, you've got like a pretty okay chip. But they're going to be playing a tee a little bit further back, which is better because they've just added that in. So they'll have the option of either hitting like iron or three wood to kind of give themselves maybe 80 or 90 yards where they can put a bit of spin on it. Or they can hit a driver. But if they hit a driver, they've got a really awkward pitch to a green that completely runs away from them that they can't get any spin into. So if you're hitting driver, you've actually got to go really far right off the tee, which the green's tucked around the left. You got to go so far right to try and get the angle in to almost hit, so the green's not completely running away from you. So it's more like hitting sideways into it, kind of like that hole that I was telling you about at Colorado.
Yeah.
So that'll be interesting how they play that, because that is a new tee since it was there last time. But it's a shame it's the first hole because I feel like they all just hit iron or something. But that's one of my favorites. And then, I mean, there's a bunch of holes that they don't actually play. There's a very similar hole on the property on the west course, number 14, which isn't part of the composite layout. And that hole's great because if you kind of aim straight at the green, and which sort of veers you into the right rough, you've just got no shot from the right rough. You just can't hold the green. Whereas you got to hit it out as far left as you can, almost up against the tee tree, which is right where Jeff Ogilvy lives, actually, in that tee tree. He lives about from that tee tree, is about 10 meters across is his backyard. That's the perfect angle in.
It would have been better if he was living in the tee tree. you know.
Yeah, well, maybe he does. I don't know.
Just sitting there watching golf.
Yeah. But yeah, that's one of the great holes there.
It'll be really cool to watch. I want to come down for that, but I don't want to come down when I can't play the golf course. So selfishly, I'm probably gonna delay that till after the President's Cup.
Yeah. Are you gonna? Because you know you've not really you've seen so much in America, but you, I mean, there's still so much probably to see, but you've never really been out, have you? Have you been to play golf in Scotland or Australia or anything like that?
I'm like an American. I'm just an American golfer. I you know, this is the hard thing. There's so much to see, and
there is.
I kind of felt like
it's kind of crazy.
There was a void in American golf coverage in terms of you know, just good golf courses to see that don't get a ton of pub. So it's like, but I got to go for personal reasons. I got to go because, you know, you have to have like the ability to relate stuff back. It's like anything. Yeah. You probably see it. Like you go and you play a course and you're like, oh, this reminds me of this hole at this place.
Yeah.
And there's so much of that.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, it's kind of like, I mean, all those old architects, they all went to Scotland and studied the Scottish courses and the holes. It's kind of like you kind of got to do it. It's just you got to see it. Where everyone got their inspiration from.
Yeah,
and so, then in Australia, you got to see how different it is and how it's still so cool.
Yeah, I've hoping New Zealand, Australia this winter, and then
awesome,
and then a heavy dose of the UK next year. So. It'll be
that'll be good.
International bound, you know.
Yeah,
can't be a fraud for much longer. So you thought about next year with the who's going to be on the bag for Masters?
Well, Will is the guy that caddied for me. So before that final round, we'd sort of talked about it. I don't know if he brought it up or if I brought it up or whatever, but because like it was sort of. At some point, we started talking about on the day before, like caddying and stuff in the Masters and all that. And then I told him on the semi or the quarter, I said, oh, look, I haven't committed to anyone yet. And I said to him, like, you're right up there kind of thing. Like, it's been going great kind of thing. And then with the success I had in the semi, I think I thought about it that night and I was like, you know what, like, he's been so great. He's a good friend. I get along with him well. We're on similar wavelengths. So the next day I told him, you know, in the morning I said, you know, I made up my mind. We're going to Augusta, so let's just get this done. And
you played to the karma too. You had to. I mean, the guy stayed.
Yeah.
Kept stopped. Yeah, I know. Didn't that go to work
as well. Yeah, he saved me like, you know, 100 US around as well, you know, with a local caddy. So yeah, it was, you know, he played it well himself, and I played it well too. So it all worked out net positive for both of us. So, yeah.
That'll be awesome. And then you were wearing a Wingfoot shirt. So you've seen it.
Yeah, it was. Yeah, so I played Wingfoot. I played it last year because I went up. I was in the New York area because I think I did a USAM qualifier up there. It wasn't the one at Whipperwill. I did one at Whipperwill this year. No, I did that this year at Whipple. I'm trying to think while I was there. I think I was up there for a qualifier. Where did I do it?
It might have been Essex. Yeah. It might have been the one you emailed me about.
No, I try to get into that one. Yeah. No, I try to get into the Essex one, but it booked out so quickly. I ended up doing one at like a Fazio course up there that was like pretty average. But that was where I went and played Wingfoot. So I had that. I picked up that jumper, that sort of violet kind of lavender colored thing that I was wearing in the morning. And it was cold. I only brought two jumpers, so sweaters, jumpers, whatever you want to call them, with me. And I wore the green one the day before, and it kind of clashed with what I was planning to wear in the in the final round. So I had to put the Wingfoot one on, which was a bit of a flex. If I'm honest, to the guy, I just like I am, you know. But he was wearing Joe was wearing an RBC Canadian Open jacket because he played there like a month before, so, or whatever it was. So he was flexing as well. So
yeah, what do you think of Wingfoot?
Yeah, I think it's really good. Yeah, it's. I mean, I hadn't seen it before Gil had done the work, but so I saw a lot of 2018 or whatever. So I mean, it's awesome. Yeah, I loved it. I think the guy I played with sort of showed me what they'd done, like extending out the green pads, so you got more sort of interesting pins in the corners, and taking out a few trees and fixed up a few of the mowing lines. And I thought it was great. Yeah. I wanted to play the east though as well, because that looked really interesting. That looks kind of like shorter, quirkier, kind of a good little path right in the trees that looked really cool as I was playing one of the holes. I can't remember. Yeah. Have you played Wingfoot?
I played it like a week ago. Awesome. The greens are so cool.
Do you play both?
Just the west. I gotta
play east and west.
I gotta go back. West. Just the west.
Yeah.
But same thing.
I want to play east when I get a chance.
I was looking at the east. I was like, man, that looks really neat. You know, like a couple of the par threes. That one, the one that's right next to nine.
Yeah.
With no bunkers.
Yeah, I think that was the one I thought. Yeah, just like raised green, like mounds all around and shit. Yeah. It was a cool couple cool views around.
I felt like, you know, it's Wingfoot's really cool because, like, if you play well, you can score out there.
You know,
but obviously,
I think you gotta. I think if you keep it in play off the tee, I think that's the biggest thing. The greens are pretty generous; they're pretty wide greens, and yeah, they're like, you know, you can have some tricky putts across them if you're not accurate with your irons. But I felt like I drove it pretty good that day and didn't really struggle. But I could imagine if you're hitting it into the rough, and it's just got to be so hard to hit those greens from the rough, and yeah.
Yeah, it's definitely you gotta drive it well out there.
Yeah,
that's like,
yeah.
But you gotta drive it everywhere if you want to play.
Yeah,
well.
Especially I mean I know it's gonna be U.S. Open conditions when I'm playing it, so the rough's gonna be crazy. And yeah, it'll be interesting.
So obviously you get the invitation. You got to be planning a Augusta trip before, right?
Yeah, I think I'm not going to go like crazy, like super early or anything like that.
You got a little bit of to deal with too, right?
Yeah, that's the issue. I'm only going to get there early, like, but not come back kind of thing. So I think I'll probably head there like mid March for a trip, because at least the course will be somewhat, I don't know, representative of what it'll be like in a month later. So I reckon I'm going to do an early-ish, mid-early March trip, stay on because I think it's the Azalea Invitationals the week after, late March.
Country Club Charleston?
Yeah, Country Club Charleston. So I reckon I'm going to stay and play that because that finishes up on like about the 25th of March, and then I could have like a week and a half to kind of prep for the Masters.
Yeah, you should see Country Club Charleston.
Yeah, I'm keen to see it.
Yeamans too. And
Palmetto's
one you should see. That's close to.
That's true, actually. I almost played that this year, that tournament. They got a good amateur tournament there. Yeah, it's a Mackenzie.
Mm-hmm. It's really really neat.
They've got actually I played the number four course at Pinehurst, and I think it's the. I guess that's like the fifth hole, maybe the third hole. No, fourth hole. I think it's a par three.
Yeah,
it's identical to that. That hole at Palmetto.
Seven.
I don't know. Palmetto, it's a signature hole. Six, yeah, seven. Six. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that course is awesome.
Yeah. No, I really want to get out there. So I'll probably head there a fair bit early. Yeah, head to the Azalea and then stay on and play a couple courses and then head to Augusta.
You'll be acclimated. So, you know?
Yeah.
It'll be, but
yeah, hey, exactly.
It's late there. I'm going to let you go. You probably got some jet lag.
a little bit.
Thanks for coming on. And hopefully we'll no talk worries, soon. Yeah. We'll see you in the spring, if not earlier.
No, definitely. If you want to get me on again as I'm readying for the event, I look forward to it.
Yeah, next one will be in person. Maybe it'll be in Australia. Who knows?
Yeah. Okay, perfect. No, that'll be really good.
Yeah.
All righty. Yeah, well, I look forward to maybe hosting you out at Metro then.
You've been listening to the Fried Egg Podcast. We do the digging for you.